Broward schools face the pressure to reopen, community colleges and the coronavirus, and a conversation about jazz and social justice. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Broward schools were set to reopen in mid-October, but the state is telling leaders in Broward that's not good enough. And under threat of losing state dollars, there's an order to reopen classrooms on Monday. We're talking with Superintendent Robert Runcie for his response. Also, during recessions, community colleges usually see an uptick in enrollment. We'll talk with the head of the Florida college system about how the coronavirus is reshaping higher ed. Finally, we're talking with jazz performer Brenda Alford. She's part of the Arts Center's Black Heritage Project, and she'll discuss the link between jazz and social justice. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, students in Broward County are still learning from home, but that could change as soon as next week. It depends if the school board decides to reopen on the 5th, as per the orders of State Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran. The Broward School Board is considering phasing in students starting in mid-October. Now, there's a special meeting scheduled tomorrow to discuss all the possibilities, and there could be a lot of state money on the line. Corcoran has threatened to pull education dollars if a district doesn't have a good enough reason to keep campuses closed next week. Joining us now is Superintendent Robert Runcie. Mr. Runcie, always a pleasure. Thank you for the time.
Yes, Louis. Thank you for having me on, and you summed it up correctly.
All right. Well, there's a lot to get to here. I do want to mention to our listeners, if you do have a question for the superintendent, you can email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. You can also tweet us out your question or post it on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. So, Superintendent Runcie, again, the meeting is tomorrow to discuss reopening of classrooms, but when do you want to open up the classrooms?
Ideally, we'd like to begin to open up our classrooms with a staggered approach, starting on October 14th, commencing on October 20th, in which we would have all students who elect to return to brick and mortar back in our classrooms. Now, what the governor and the commissioner effectively have directed us to do is to start that process 9 days earlier. 9 days makes a really big difference in ensuring that we can prepare in an orderly manner. It's certainly going to create a number of challenges for our teachers, administrators, and staff. For example, we have just concluded our survey of teachers regarding their intent to return to school. That was completed last night. The survey from our parents indicating whether their children will remain at home and continue e-learning or return to school, that was also completed last night. So we have to now begin to match all of that up, deal with all the logistics surrounding that, everything from our bus routes to ensuring that we have sufficient laptops available in schools. So there's a lot of planning to do. That is now condensed in an extremely short period of time.
All right. I wanted to know what you're using to determine the best and safest way to reopen, because, look, the education commissioner has argued his argument that you had all summer to get ready for this. So why would an extra 9-10 days be necessary?
So what I will say is that if you look at our experience in Broward County, we opened on August 19th. Many other districts delayed for 2 weeks or more. We opened in e-learning. I think by all accounts, that was significantly improved and fairly successful in Broward County. That's a credit to our teachers and what they've been able to do over the summer and prepare to better engage our students. We indicated in our plan that was approved to the state that in September, after Labor Day, we would begin to continue to work with our public health officials, medical experts, monitor the data, make sure that there weren't any spikes that were coming up after Labor Day, and then we would make a decision. We did that on September 8th. We signaled to the board, it's time for us to begin to look at this information. And on September 22nd, we sat down and the board agreed on those particular dates that we indicated to, again, start on the 14th.
What was your first impression of that letter from Richard Corcoran when he said Monday, October 5th, or else?
At first, I thought that they had made some mistake in that letter, maybe confusing us with maybe another district, maybe Miami-Dade, because our reopening plan that they approved said that, and we followed it precisely in terms of how it's structured. We have several gating criteria which we put in that innovative plan. Those include the community had to move to phase two, which occurred in Broward around September 14th. We also looked at disease progression, the number of cases, to see what the trend is there. We also look at the ability to manage the spread, and that is the turnaround time for testing, contact tracing, what's going on in the health system. And finally, we look at district safeguards, right? Those are the factors and things that we need to put in place. That's everything from signage to plexiglass to cleaning supplies. We're making sure that we put the highest rated MERV filters in all of our HVAC systems. So all of that needed to be in place. And so I was concerned that when they said that it was inconsistent with our plan, the date that we selected, I argue that what we did was precisely consistent with our plan.
Have you spoken with Commissioner Corcoran since his letter came out Friday?
Oh, yes. I've spoken to him several times.
Okay.
I've spoken to his staff.
So tell me how those conversations went. What is he saying to you?
I think there's a very clear message that we need to open on October 5th. That's been the consistent theme of those conversations. Look, we all want to open our schools as soon as we possibly can. We know our students need to be in our classrooms and receiving the services and supports that many of them need. And so we all want to do that, but we want to do that in an orderly way. We want to do it in a safe way and in a smart way. And so we had a schedule that we had mapped out to be able to do that. And it worked out kind of nicely for us because October 16th is the end of the first marking period in Broward County. So pivoting from e-learning, given the fact that all those indicators would be met, we would switch over the district to brick and mortar that's face-to-face around that time.
Yeah.
That was what our plan is, and that's what we had approved.
So Miami-Dade School Board announced yesterday during a special meeting that they are going to reopen on Monday, again, following the pressure from the state. And look, that's the largest school district, and a lot of times they set the precedent for all other school districts. Do you feel pressure to move the start date based on what Miami-Dade is doing?
Well, I don't feel any pressure from Miami-Dade. I deal with the state, right? I don't report to the Miami-Dade School Board. It's the state of Florida. It's the commissioner and the folks I'm having a conversation with. They are, driving the agenda and what we may do here. And so any pressure we receive is and will be coming from the state.
But it's not. I know it's not pressure. Carvalho's not putting pressure on you. I'm just saying that what they do is that pressure on you then to act because of what they're doing.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, if Dade is open, it makes it harder for us to sustain the argument with the state that we need to continue with the dates that we have in our plan that was approved. And that we need those 9 additional days. Again, I still argue that we do. But it's somewhat of a challenge. And we will have a meeting tomorrow to deliberate this topic with our school board on the possibility of opening our schools starting next week.
Again, I'm talking with Broward County School Superintendent Robert Runcie. They have a special meeting coming up tomorrow, again, to discuss the reopening of classrooms. State Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran last week sent a letter to all districts saying you got to start Monday, October 5th, or have a good reason for not doing so. And they're threatening state dollars. Mr. Runcie, you talked about a survey from the teachers and parents. Okay, what did it tell you? What are the teachers saying to you?
Well, we just concluded that last night. Staff is crunching through that data to see what those numbers are, so I don't have them yet, but I can tell you historically what we found, at least on the survey from our parents and families, is that somewhere between 30 to 40% of parents had elected in the past for e-learning. And I think that number may go up during this survey for, you know, a couple of reasons. I think folks still have some apprehension and concern out there related to this pandemic. Number two, we've done, I think, an outstanding job in Broward County in ramping up and improving the quality of the e-learning experience. And so we've gotten a lot of good feedback from families on that. So that number should probably be fairly significant. Yeah.
Besides the surveys, though, I mean, you having conversations with parents and teachers? I want to know what they're saying to you.
Oh, yes, we are. We are. We have parents conversations with them regularly. I mean, just this past weekend, you know, I was on with our Broward County PTA as well. Received, you know, emails, calls, and things from parents and teachers regularly. I think folks are, one, they are continue to remain concerned about health and safety of bringing kids back to school during a pandemic. That those are valid concerns that folks should have. I certainly want to reassure everyone that we are taking every precaution that we need to and putting all the safety measures that we need to put in place as specified by the CDC, our local health officials. We've been working on planning for months. So we'll be ready.
All right. So look, again, Corcoran is threatening state funding. You know, how much could Broward lose?
So there are essentially two areas of flexibility that you receive under the executive order and the innovative plans that have been approved by the state. And first is around the FTE, which is the per student dollar that you get for enrollment. And so what the state has done, recognizing that this is a unprecedented time and that we're in a state of flux, really, in terms of a lot of different educational models the districts are implementing. They're giving districts the FTE count based on the forecast that we all have, right? So that impact to us could be north of $60 million. There's another category which we receive full credit for innovative learning environments, which means we're going to continue to receive dollars for students, whether they are sitting in a classroom or they're learning remotely through our e-learning environment. If we don't have that type of flexibility, the amount of funding that is at risk there, it would be disastrous for Broward County. And so I have to balance out what's in the best interest of our kids, our teachers in this county, versus, you know, continuing to try to take a hard line for these 9 days, which we would certainly need to have and like to have. But I'm not going to risk significant financial hardship for this district, which ultimately is going to hurt our kids in our classrooms.
So are you worried? Yeah. Are you worried that this sets a precedent that the state will make decisions for school districts instead of the locally elected officials?
Yeah, it's interesting because in the executive order, it states that these type of decisions are really up to the local district, but they have certainly superseded that given the current circumstances and the executive order that has been put in place. So yes, it's a concern, but I don't want this to be a distraction from what our core mission is, and that's focusing on delivering the best education services we can to our kids. We have still continued to provide mental health services, social emotional learning. We continue to provide food, technology, you name it. We need to continue to provide that.
I want to come back to the teachers just for a moment. We heard from Broward mm-hmm. County Teachers Union President Anna Fusco, who consistently raised concerns about the classrooms, that they're not ready. This is what she said.
What happens when someone gets the symptoms or somebody actually contracts COVID? How are they going to handle with students that, you know, possibly have it? What's it look like for, you know, quarantining them? Do you close down the whole class? Do you close down the whole school? You know, there's tons of questions what we're trying to do to protect the employee, protect their sick time, protect their health, and of course the student. You know, what is social distancing going to look like in the classroom? Is it going to look like in the halls? Where are they eating lunch? Are we having recess?
So, Superintendent Runcie, can you say on the record, classrooms are ready to handle students and protect them and protect teachers?
Yes, they are ready to handle students coming back and protect teachers and everyone to the best of our ability. I am not ever going to say that we have an environment that's 100% COVID-free and there won't be any cases. That's impossible for us to determine. But have we put in all the safeguards that we know we should be putting in, safeguards that are recommended by CDC, public health officials? Absolutely. And, you know, regarding, you know, many of the questions I just heard, we certainly address those. We have protocols in place. When we do have a student who presents symptoms, or it could be a teacher or some staff member, we have nurses in every school now. We have isolation rooms that are established. We have protocols set up with the Florida Department of Health. In fact, they have now put us on the list of essential services where we will get priority testing for any cases that arrive. If they need to test any students or staff, that will be done with 24 to 48 hour turnaround. There's 11 sites they've dedicated to us that we can use. So yes, we are, we put things in place to make sure that we can open as safe as possible. But again, you know, I'm not going to tell our parents and our community that we have, you know, an environment that is 100% safe and free from contracting COVID. There is no such place.
Let me finish with this. Coming up in the meeting tomorrow, I mean, you just said a little while ago, you don't want to risk losing the money to run this district, you know, which could be upwards of $60 million or more. What are you going to push for tomorrow in the meeting?
Well, I think, one, we want to just lay out the full picture, the context that we're in, the correspondence we received from the state, what our responses were. We're going to lay out a proposed schedule for under which we could reopen starting next week in a phased manner. That will be presented to the board as a proposal for consideration. So we will present a path to get there, to make it happen. And again, it's not ideal. It's not what we planned for. It's not what was approved by the state. But, you know, we're going to have to figure out how to make it work. It presents challenges, but we've always had challenges. And I know that all of our staff, our administrators, our teachers, they will rise to the challenge and do what we need to do to make sure that we provide a quality education and a safe environment for all students in Broward County.
He is Broward County School Superintendent Robert Runcie. Superintendent Runcie, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, you can follow what happens in tomorrow's school board meeting at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, the pandemic is reshaping the economy, but how will community colleges help people prepare for those changes? And by the way, you're listening to jazz singer Brenda Alford. Our conversation about Songs of Freedom comes up later in the program.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Oh,
welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami-Dade College started in-person classes this week, and this school year is already looking dramatically different. The third largest community college system in the country is experiencing its largest enrollment drop in its 60-year history. And Miami-Dade isn't alone. The pandemic has hit community colleges across the state and the country hard, impacting enrollment and finances. Now, usually during an economic downturn, schools see an uptick in enrollment as job opportunities disappear. But the pandemic is bucking the trend. Kathy Hebda is the chancellor of Florida's college system, overseeing 28 colleges across the state, and she joins us now to talk about this. Chancellor Hebda, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Louis.
You know, we are now more than a month into the fall semester for community colleges, but I'm wondering, how successful have schools been in reducing the spread of the coronavirus, and are you getting the data to know the difference?
Thanks for your question. Our colleges started early on in the Florida college system, or sometimes known as the Great 28. They started early on back in March when the pandemic first hit, prioritizing taking care of their students and their faculty and staff. And even as they were rapidly going to all online instruction, they were also planning for coming back. And each one of them submitted plans to the Department of Education this summer that were so thoughtful, well thought out, flexible, had contingencies that continued to prioritize safety and high-quality learning environments. And that's the hallmark of the Florida college system, is flexible and high-quality learning environments. And so they've learned lessons during the pandemic, just like everybody else has, and they've begun to apply them to their ongoing instruction, what is best for our students and those who are not yet our students that we are recruiting into the college system that live in our neighborhoods. We've done very well in the college system managing all of those different eventualities and responding quickly.
I wanted to ask you about this. At the end of August, the governor's office called on state colleges and universities to send daily reports of COVID infections. Have they been doing that? Are they getting those reports?
He did request, and the commissioner requested, actually, the commissioner of education wanted to keep, I guess, information coming to the department, because we, many times at the state level, can get the bigger picture of what's happening across school systems. So, and then we can offer ways to help. We can also use that information to connect people that might be having similar circumstances happen. And so they can work with each other and pass on those best and effective practices. So for about a month, we received data from colleges and school districts about how those kinds of things were happening in their on their campuses, you know, once they did reopen more to face-to-face. And as I said, it really proved to be very enlightening and helpful in how responsive colleges were and how they were able to adjust to different situations and implement those plans that they had worked so hard on. So we don't collect that data anymore. We just did it for about a month, and we were able to connect some folks that were able to help each other, and it worked out great.
I wanted to move to the other point that I made in the introduction about enrollment. So earlier we spoke with Miami-Dade College Interim President Rolando Montoya about this, and he talked about the lack of enrollment for the fall semester and the impact that's going to have on finances. This is what he said.
If this situation doesn't get corrected, there is a point in which you will have to make a complete evaluation of all the expenses. Things cannot continue business as usual. Let's begin with the idea that although most of the costs in colleges and universities are fixed, that means that you need probably the same personnel when you have a classroom with 20 students versus when you have a classroom with 15. Still, you need to find a way to reduce costs.
So, Chancellor Hebda, you know, normally in economic downturns, we see enrollment go up because people need to change careers, but it's different, isn't it? This pandemic is different.
There are some differences, yes. And it's interesting. I think we're still learning what those differences are, because in the college system, it's a little different than in universities and in public schools, where you think the fall semester starts on a certain date, and that's the last chance you have to enroll until spring semester starts in January. That's not exactly true in the college system. We have opportunities throughout the fall in our institutions to enroll in a variety of programs. And so whereas it may seem like on a certain day that enrollment is going to be down for the entire academic year, it may look down right now, but there are so many other times for students to enroll, which is one of the exciting things I want to talk about while I'm with you today is the Get There campaign. There are plenty of opportunities for students to still enroll. And so whereas over the summer it looked like for some colleges their enrollment is not where they were hoping it would be, we have several colleges that are actually up in enrollment compared to where they were last year. So, and we have lots of opportunities for people throughout this semester and the next semester to continue to enroll.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that program. It's a campaign that's starting up. I just want to mention, again, I'm talking with Kathy Hebda, Chancellor of Florida's College Systems, again, talking about how the state's 28 community colleges are responding to the pandemic and implementing a workforce training program. Let's talk about this campaign that's focused on workforce training initiatives, focused on the job needs specific to the things that have popped up during this pandemic. Chancellor, where are the greatest opportunities right now? What has the pandemic shown us where students want to go now?
We have some exciting opportunities. There are some areas of employment that did not suffer as much as other areas of employment. We all are very familiar. We've heard the stories about the service industry, tourism, restaurants, those kinds of things that are taking longer to come back because of the challenges of social distancing and things like that. They will come back. They're already coming back. In the meantime, there are a wealth of opportunities for students in other areas that are really exciting.
Like what?
Engineering and technology, energy, information technology, especially cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is something that every business and entity needs, no matter how small or large they are. And there just are a myriad of offerings and things that students can do. They don't have to get a complete bachelor's degree, although you can in cybersecurity, and Miami-Dade offers one of those. It's one of our three state colleges that do offer baccalaureate degrees in cybersecurity.
Yeah,
but there are AS programs, there are certificate programs, short-term programs that you can get certificates in various areas of cybersecurity and start working in those fields right away.
And I just to mention, we did do an interview about Miami-Dade College's new program in cybersecurity. I wanted to ask you about Broward College. They had this unique program in place that could be applicable elsewhere. They built an industry certifications into the curriculum, along with other opportunities to partner with local businesses. Do you see a program like that perhaps expanding? Why hasn't it happened yet?
If you're talking about Broward Up, and I think you might be.
Yes.
A week does not go by that I don't talk about this program with somebody. And it actually is being replicated in various ways throughout our colleges. And I'll take a step back just for a second and say that part of the college system mission as open access institutions is not only to welcome everyone who comes to our door, but actually we have a responsibility in each of our college system districts to reach out to those individuals who can't, won't, don't realize that they can attend post-secondary and gain a valuable skill, a degree, a myriad of things that can help them and their family really become economically upwardly mobile and continue that lifelong learning that we're all going to need as we go into the 21st, 22nd century. So because of that mindset, because of that reaching out mindset and going to where the students are and where our citizens are, as opposed to hoping they will come to us, the Broward Up program is a prime example of just that. What they did at Broward College was they partnered with Harvard, and some of this data is also available even through the Florida Chamber of Commerce, to actually look at Broward County as a whole. And before the pandemic, Broward County as a whole had an unemployment rate of about 3.5%, which
right.
is really good.
Yeah.
At the same time, there were locations in Broward County that had unemployment rates as high as 12 or 18%. And so they overlaid that information and where those locations were in Broward County with where their campus centers were located and realized they didn't have any place anywhere near those residents
yeah.
where they could go and get an education.
I apologize.
So now what they've done is they've planted the flag, so to speak, in those areas and had those MOUs and agreements with local,
and
cities.
I'm going to have to jump in. I apologize only because of time. You know what? This campaign, again, we're going to put more on our social media at WLRN Sundial because, again, as the economic downturn has changed and shifted the economy, The community colleges are going to be the place where people can find opportunities elsewhere. I got to stop there, though. Florida College System Chancellor Kathy Hebda, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. Go to GetThereFlorida.org.
All right. Still to come, jazz music and the fight against racism. Singer Brenda Alford shares her story with us up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Jazz and gospel singer Brenda Alford has been educating young people about the role of black musicians in social justice movements for decades. She was an activist throughout her college years as she gained success in Baltimore and then in Miami, working with legendary performers like Horace Silver. She continued a message of celebrating black music. Alford is part of a new virtual salon series beginning tonight called the Black Heritage Project. Over the next 6 months, the Adrian R. Center for the Performing Arts is bringing together local community leaders and cultural experts to discuss the history of social justice and the influence of black art on American culture. We spoke with Alford yesterday about the theme of tonight's event, Songs of Freedom. Brenda, I wanted to start with this. At what point did you realize that gospel, jazz, and R&B could be a vehicle for you to educate children, but also inspire social change?
I realized when I was young and listening to the music, listening to all three genres. There was the church music that I kind of grew up on, Hold On a Little While Longer, Everything's Gonna Be All Right, and Steal Away to Jesus. I learned about the old Negro spirituals when I was a kid. Growing up in East Baltimore, we listened to that quasi-classical music in my home and, you know, in the neighborhood activities. The church that I went to did the old-fashioned gospel spiritual music, so I heard those words there, and all those songs were uplifting, and some were songs of sorrow, but most were songs of hope and faith. And then, of course, when I became really aware of the movement when I was in my teens, We Shall Overcome was the big song. Well, I had first learned that song in church, and it was I'll overcome someday. But the mass embracement of that song led me to understand that this was a song for the movement. So that's how I became enlightened, I guess, or awakened.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the legendary jazz saxophonist John Coltrane, who, of course, groundbreaking performer, and he pushed the boundaries of the genre. But I wanted to take a little bit of a listen to his piece, Alabama, performed live at the Berlin Jazz Club in New York City. This was October of 1963. This song was performed 1 month after the 16th Street Church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama. What does the song mean to you, listening to it now, all these decades later?
Wow. I have to say that this project, Freedom Songs, enlightened me. I was quite shocked because I liked that song, Alabama. I loved John Coltrane. But when it was being played and when I became aware of it as a teenager, I did not realize that he had composed that because of the 16th Street Church bombing. Well, it has come full circle because now I am married to the brother-in-law of one of the little girls who was killed in that bombing. And I always loved the song. There was a melancholy about it. There was a freedomness about it. There was a defiance about it. And I always identified with it. But I did not know as a teenager. Because in 1963, I was a kid. I was 13. And my mother wouldn't let me go out and march. I would hear little bits on the news and, you know, things like that. But I was not in the thick of it. That song has really, really just impacted me and my life and my emotions.
You know, reading upon your story, I mean, there were so many moments throughout your life where you were forced to confront pervasive racism in society. You spoke with one of my producers about the weekend Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered and how that experience continues to resonate with you today, right?
Yes, that weekend I was in New Jersey on spring break with my family. I got trapped in New Jersey because of the riots and I couldn't get home. So when I finally got home that Sunday, I got out of the cab and I just wanted to just be with my mother. You know, I needed to be home. And the entrance to where I lived was blocked by big tanks and soldiers with bayonets. I found out later it was the National Guard, but it was soldiers with bayonets to me. I was literally in shock. It was just a horrific experience that, I mean, even to this day, it still resonates. I was lost. I was confused because I knew that when I left New Jersey that I was going to come to my peaceful home. But that's not what I confronted when I got here. And the neighborhood surrounding where I lived was burned and torn down. It was quite a shock.
Did that experience lead you to the activism that you took throughout your years in college?
Some of it, yeah. And there were personal experiences that led me to it as well. I was standing on the corner getting the bus, going to class, because I was working toward my degree. We weren't wealthy. I paid for my education. And I worked 11 to 7 and got off and went to the bus stop at 8 a.m. But a carload of white men came down the street in before the bus and swerved over to the curb where I was waiting and yelled racial epithets at me and spit in my face and took off. I had a choice as to whether or not I was going to go home, cry, and you know, bathe, or get on that bus and take that exam. And I thought about it for a split second, and I said, they will not snatch my education away from me. That stands out to me because that was kind of a turning point for me. I was almost 19. I guess that kind of flipped the switch. I marched with the other students after that. I protested after that. I learned how to put Vaseline on my face to repel the tear gas, the whole nine yards. I was there.
So was music an escape for you, or was performing music part of that social activism?
I was not a performer, even though I loved to sing. And I did sing, you know, in church and in my neighborhood, sometimes little talent shows and things like that. But it's funny, singing those songs was not a part of my activism. I say my activism, I say that and put it in quotations because there were people out there doing much more than I was, okay? But I did sing as an outlet. After I grew older, actually, I was more of an activist than I guess more of an effective activist, because I taught children how to respect people of all races. That's where I feel like the strength of my activism has been. And the strength of my activism has been using music and teaching all colors of children, all races of children, about how Black music has evolved, what it evolved from, and how it can open doors for understanding. So that's the activism that was triggered by all of that.
In those conversations that you had with young people, What do you think we're getting wrong in the curriculum, in what we're teaching them?
Okay, you opened up a can, but I have to be honest. A lot of the history that we were taught, and a lot of the history that I was taught, was the history that as a teacher, I had a responsibility to teach. And I'm retired now. And I looked, and as I've done research over the years and looked at the curriculums, I've been required to teach, there are many things that are not true. Or there are many truths that are left out. And it's so hard. I learning as I get older these truths. And I wonder, the question I ask myself, how would I teach a child, you know, the truth about the European invasion of the North American continent? Because that's basically what it was. When so many Native Americans were killed off and killed by disease and just meanness, you know, I didn't teach that when I was a teacher. That's not what was in my required curriculum. So I guess when you're asking what's missing, the dirty truth.
I'm speaking with jazz and gospel singer Brenda Alford. She'll be in a virtual conversation this evening as part of the Arts Center's Black Heritage Project. The event is called Songs of Freedom. We've included the Zoom link on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I wanted to get a little bit into, you know, how really you got into singing, because while you were living in Baltimore, you had the opportunity to work with some of the greats, some of the jazz greats, Horace Silver, Charlie Covington, Cyrus Chestnut. You were encouraged to become a singer by the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. How did they shape your style as a musician and your approach to the art form?
Well, a couple of my... Actually, two that you mentioned, Charlie Covington and Cyrus Chestnut, they shaped my approach, because with them, I could sing anything, any way, in any key that I wanted. They are geniuses. So they kind of ruined me for other piano players. But they gave me the freedom to be as creative as I wanted to be. So with that freedom, I was just able to do exactly what I wanted to do. And a lot of musicians said that because I knew what I wanted to hear and what I wanted to do, they had a lot of respect for me. So, you know, without these guys, I don't know what kind of performer I would have been. But I'm grateful, and I thank God every day for that kind of experience starting out. And then Ella Fitzgerald, she just told me point blank, "You're a singer?" And I said, "Well, I try to be." She said, "Don't try, you do it." And she sat me down and she talked to me. And it was just the most amazing experience. It really changed my life. It really changed my life.
That is lovely. Thank you. I wanted to ask you about a song. About the song, "Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child." This is a song that resonates with the message of the event that's coming up at the Arts Center, Songs of Freedom. Let's take a listen to that song.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel...
You know, Brenda, I wanted to know a little bit of the history of that song, and how did you make this part of your own story?
Well, it's a song that I'd been hearing since I was a very little girl, you know, in the folk era. So the song has been there. It was there before I was there. And it resonated with me because of some of the personal experiences that I had. That time I told you about the white man spitting in my face, things that I went through on various jobs because I was not a white girl, being called names, you know, those kinds of things. And when those kinds of things happen, my mother was my anchor. My mother was like, her arms were my safe haven. And when those guards, those National Guard guys, crossed their bayonets and would not allow me to enter my own home, I felt like a motherless child. Because all that, my goal had been to get back home to my mother. I have to say it, when that saliva was dripping on my face, the anger and the fright that I had made me want to run home to my mother. And at that time, I felt like I was endangered, and I felt like a motherless child. And when you, it's a throwback to slavery. Think about those bodies, those people who were considered cargo and forced to come across the sea, across the ocean, and being taken from their homes, being taken from their loving families, whatever. And how did they feel? In fact, I started using that song as soon as I went back into the school system to teach about Black music and the origins of jazz. And I used that song as an illustration so that the kids would understand how it felt to be captured, carried away, and have to recreate a life. So that's how that song resonates for me.
Wow, that is an amazing story. Thinking about those kids and using that as a teaching tool, I got to know, reflecting on the racial justice protests during the civil rights era, how do you see the protest movement today? How has it evolved?
It has evolved because I see more unity. I see people of all races this time. Back then, there were some very brave non-African Americans who marched with us. There were some very outspoken, you know, honorable people who stood shoulder to shoulder with the leaders of the movement. And that was very important because it brought it into the national spotlight. It put it on TV. Now I see people of all persuasions. I see young and old. It crosses generations. It crosses races. And this is progress. This is progress. And of course, we still have a long way to go. But the fact that it's out there and then we have social media, I think this is a time that is going to go down in history.
You have a new album that's coming out that wrestles with the social justice issues in the wake of the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and so many others. Again, I wanted to listen just a little bit to this song, I'll Never Give Up.
I'll never give up, never stop believing. In that miracle, something inside me says will come to be.
I wanted to ask you why it was important for you to be part of this conversation now with this music.
That song was written as a vehicle of encouragement and motivation and hope. Hope for anybody who stops and listens to it. I wrote that song out of my own experiences as being feeling crushed sometimes. And these times that we are living in right now are definitely times that can make people feel crushed. I actually released the song because I wanted to make sure that the message gets out to others. I wrote it for me initially. I was going through some very tough times in my life when I wrote that song. And I realized that it shouldn't be for me. It should be for others. Because there are a lot of people out there who suffer much more than I do. And right now, so many people are suffering. So that is The name of the album is Messages, Songs for the Soul. When you get your soul lifted up off of the floor, when you get your soul to look to the sun, when you get your soul to pick up your feet, then you can move forward and you can achieve things you never thought you could achieve before. You can survive.
That was jazz and gospel singer Brenda Alford. She'll be in a virtual conversation this evening as part of the Arts Center's Black Heritage Project. The event is called Songs of Freedom. We've included the Zoom link on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And keep tuned to Brenda's website, Brenda Alford. That's ALFORD.com. Her new album, Messages, Songs for the Soul, will be available soon. Well, that's Sundial for this Wednesday, September 30th. Coming up tomorrow, just to mention, we are entering the fall pledge drive. We still have a Sundial show, but remember that, look, you look to us for honest, truthful, and fair coverage of the news. We're going to ask you to help us continue to bring you that service. Pledge your support for programs like this one. Also, by the way, 50 years ago this Sunday, PBS launched its first broadcast, the French chef Julia Child. Public broadcasting has confronted financial and political challenges over the last five decades and continues to serve as a critical role in education, journalism, and entertainment. Tomorrow, we're going to talk to the president and CEO of PBS. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you again live tomorrow.